Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Well, it's a new year, and at the watershed between 2024 and 2025, some readers, some listeners, will have remembered this couplet by Ogden Nash, which goes, "Hark, it's midnight, children dear. Duck, here comes another year." Well, it's come at us, and it's already a doozy. Let's hope that this number of the JPGN Journal Club, led by Dr. Jake Mann, will hold up under the stresses of 2025. Before we move along to the articles to which Jake wants to direct our attention today, take a look, if you don't mind, at https://espigan.org/knowledge-center. There's a monothematic conference on steatotic liver disease in children coming up in just 2 weeks' time. And then in March, there's a GI immunology masterclass. And in April, a meeting on nutritional assessment in artificially fed children with chronic intestinal disorders. It may be a bit late to sign up for these or to arrange your schedule to attend these, but it's not too late yet to log yourself in for the Helsinki annual meeting of ESPIGAN from the 14th through the 17th of May. Yes, the summer calendar is empty after that, at least online, until early September. But things get crowded then, so sign up early before the autumn's offerings all are booked. Jake, your choices for discussion today. You have one that's what I would call news we can use from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition by Anderson and co-authors writing from Helsinki and Stockholm. Serum bile acids early after portoenterostomy are predictive for native liver survival and portal hypertension in biliary atresia. And as a counterweight to that, a very heavy counterweight, I might say, is something from the Journal of Experimental Medicine by Gusenpour et al., writing from, all over the map, but Paris, Rotterdam, and Toronto seem to be where the senior authors are based. Human variants in ITGAV, which encodes integrin alpha-5, are associated with immune dysregulation, brain abnormalities, and colitis. Which would you like to start with?
I think let's start with Anderson et al.
Anderson et al. Well, if we have any credit with laypersons, we meaning we physicians, it's because we can tell the future. That is, we can watch a patient and say, if the fever breaks tonight, then she will survive, and if not, she will die within 3 days. That's a remarkable thing to be able to do. A family that has gone through a pregnancy and come out with what seems to be a perfect baby that then within weeks has difficulty with gaining weight and starts to turn yellow, that's a remarkable blow. That can only be deeply unsettling because children are meant to be perfect. But here you are and you've been handed the diagnosis that the daughter and heir is afflicted with biliary atresia. She needs surgery now. Well, what will happen after the surgery, doctor? Well, we don't know. We have to wait and watch and see. And that must plunge parents into horrible uncertainty. Jake, I don't get to watch this at the bedside, but have I summed up what happens pretty well?
Pretty well, yeah. When counseling these patients, typically we would say that at some point in their life, they will need a liver transplant. But it really is at some point in their life. You don't know if they will need a liver transplant at 5 months old or 40 years old. And there's been a huge amount of work to try and establish accurate prognostic markers. And this paper is a I think, a very helpful contribution to that field.
Well, what does the paper say? If I've read it right, it says that we've been watching serum bilirubin, seeing whether it clears and how long it stays cleared for, as a prognostic marker, as something that will let us tell the future for this family's child. But it's not the best, or it could be better, and one of the things that could be better seems to be serum bile acids.
Exactly. So clearance of jaundice, defined as a normal bilirubin at 6 months post-Kasai, has been generally defined as the marker of putting someone into a good risk group if they do achieve clearance of jaundice, or a poor risk group if they do not. And this work really has shown that in the group who clear jaundice, those who have higher serum bile acids, their analysis was significant at 3 months post-Kasai, but there was a trend also at 6 months post-Kasai. Those who have higher serum bile acids, even those with a normal serum bilirubin, have poorer native liver survival, as in they're more likely to get progressive liver disease, portal hypertension, and require a liver transplant. And this is a retrospective study, but a very, very well-respected group. The Helsinki group have made multiple major contributions to across the field of pediatric surgery, and they have 10 years follow-up data. And this data is also consistent with data from the US in a larger cohort. So now we have really two completely independent studies that are supporting the prognostic data on serum bile acids, even as early as 3 months post-Kasai.
All right. So, Jake, the point at which we can start to measure serum bile acids and have it mean something is 3 months after jaundice is cleared, or 3 months after surgery, or...?
3 months after surgery, at least according to this analysis. The challenge with those sorts of things is that the uncertainty is greater where there is larger variability, and the paper shows quite a helpful graph illustrating the serum bile acids in the group that clears jaundice and the group that does not clear jaundice. And there is a large amount of overlap earlier on at 1 month, 3 months post-Kasai. But once you get to 6 months post-Kasai, clearly the group who've cleared jaundice also have lower serum bile acids than the ones who have not cleared jaundice. But it's that group in the middle, those who have cleared jaundice but have high serum bile acids, are much more likely to have poorer native liver survival. And I think that there are two kind of important implications for this. The first one really is conceptual, that bilirubin, serum bilirubin, is evidently not a particularly good, or is not the optimum marker of the efficacy of bile drainage in patients post-Kasai. And it underscores the fact that we need to think about the prognostic output, or the prognostic outcome of children with biliary atresia, as a spectrum where the lower their bilirubin, the better. Whilst it didn't stand up in this paper, there are other papers to show that if you achieve a bilirubin of 6, you do better than a bilirubin of 10 versus a bilirubin of 19, even though that they all fall into the category of clearance of jaundice. So presumably there are many children at a molecular, or probably at a cellular level, who, even though they have a normal serum bilirubin, still have cholestasis. And then the second point really is slightly more practical. For example, if you saw a child who seem to have cleared their jaundice, but then you measured and they had high serum bile acids, you would probably watch them just that little bit more closely if they seem to have a fever or any other signs of cholangitis, and you would probably opt for more like 3 weeks of IV antibiotics rather than 2 weeks of IV antibiotics if they did have an episode of cholangitis. So I think it is a relatively straightforward paper that could influence practice.
Jake, do you think that they've shared all their data with us? I ask because often prognostic studies or studies that attempt to identify prognostic markers come up with scores that include more than one variable. This is one-stop shopping. You get your serum bile acids and you know where you are once the jaundice has been cleared. Do you think that they're waiting to come up with some combination of, a correction factor for serum transaminase activities and for gamma GT, something that pile it all into the hopper and you know to the month, if not to the week, when the kid's out of the woods?
It does seem like that the authors have already included a large number of variables in their analysis to see what stood out by trying to put in a large, multiple factors and see what came out in both univariable and multivariable analysis. And
there, we're not given the details of that in this paper, though, of what they tried and what didn't work.
We have some of them in table two, but presumably that they have other factors. And I think we do have to acknowledge that whilst this, I've a reasonably high degree of confidence of the reliability and accuracy of this data, it is data from 56 children. Whereas if you had data from 500 children, you may well see an effect of other factors. For example, you could even tweak the way that some of these analyses are done. So, for example, they've included a dichotomous factor for children who had a Kasai done at over 60 days of age, whereas we know that that really influences your ability for native liver survival as a continuous trait rather than as a single cutoff at 60 days.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see any particular mention of a difference between kids with cystic biliary atresia and kids with syndromic biliary atresia, the ones that have you can't even see that they have their heart in the right place, can you? Sometimes it's on the wrong side. What I'll call garden variety biliary atresia for the purpose of this attack on you. Do you think that we're going to see differences in survival with those factors plugged in?
I think that there is other data that very clearly illustrates that cystic biliary atresia does better, presumably because they have some cystic remnant of the main bile duct that is already draining, and then they have more like a cystoenterostomy. Whereas, interestingly, there was a very large prognostic study recently published by the UK group, which showed no difference or no substantial difference between syndromic biliary atresia and non-syndromic biliary atresia. I mean, I think that it does depend whether we're talking about a kind of factor going into Kasai, something about how biliary atresia is made up in the first place, versus a marker of describing the efficacy of the Kasai. And they don't necessarily have to both tell the same story.
They may not track together. Gotcha. Well, I did my best to complicate that, and I'm not certain that I succeeded. But as you say, it looks as if it's going to be something that we ought to start following. Now, as for the other one, I was forced to reacquaint myself with integrins, what they are, what they do, their favorite foods, their birthdays. It turns out that integrins are obligate heterodimers. There are alpha integrins and there are beta integrins, and the integrins that are inserted into cell membranes as triggers or levers contain an alpha and a beta subunit. They mediate cell interactions with extracellular matrix and with other cells. Two integrins, including ITGAV, integrin alpha 5 and a beta 6 subunit, and alpha 5 and a beta 8 subunit, activate transforming growth factor beta. TGF-beta, in turn, regulates aspects of chemotaxis and of cell proliferation, differentiation, and activation, and has its finger in nearly every immune response pie. Ghasempur and co-workers seem to have started, although it's not particularly clear, with genomic searches in several children with immunodeficiency, complex congenital malformations involving the central nervous system, and colitis, real colitis in one child actually requiring colectomy. Those searches uncovered variants in ITGAV, which is conveniently the same abbreviation for integrin alpha 5 as is the protein abbreviation. One's in italic typeface, the other's in normal typeface. That's the only difference. When ITGAV was expressed in cell lines from the children, or when the expression of ITGAV in cell lines from the children was assessed, it was found to be substantially but not entirely ablated. ITGAV knockout mice don't do well at all, much less come to term, and survive for years. In turn, there was reduced nuclear accumulation of a transcriptional regulator that binds to the promoter regions of DNA. And I am not making this name up. It's called S. Mothers Against Decapentaplegic Homolog 3. If you didn't have your pencil and paper out, let me repeat. S. Mothers Against Decapentaplegic Homolog 3. That is activated by transforming growth factor beta. So the cascade from upstream ITGAV expression to downstream disorders of the TGF-beta pathway seems clear. And as it happens, variants in TGF-beta 1, which encodes TGF-beta, or in the gene encoding the TGF-beta receptor, are found in children with faulty brain development and inflammatory bowel disease. You can't do anything and get published without tormenting a zebrafish, it seems to me. And they did the appropriate. They ablated the zebrafish orthologue of ITGAV, and they found nervous system defects and gut inflammation in the resulting minnows. So another demonstration that TGF-beta 1 and its targets are weak points in at least some patients with inflammatory bowel disease. I can't tell you how long it took to come up with that summary. I had to write it out, but there we are. Did I get it right?
Absolutely. I mean, really, I was most impressed with their ability to perform a colonoscopy on a zebrafish. But otherwise, it was another one of these interesting papers that has, I think, conceptual interest as a pediatric gastroenterologist. I think the last one we talked about was also probably in JX Med, a Journal of Experimental Medicine, where they've found a family with very early onset IBD, and it's linked to a monogenic disorder. And then the things that kind of give me goosebumps is where it all just sort of fits together. And here, the conceptual point, as you said, is that they have defects in integrin alpha 5, and we know that the integrins membrane bound, but they then activate TGF beta that is kicking around in the extracellular matrix in its inactive form. And then one of these immune cells that's got the integrins bumps into the TGF beta in the matrix, activates it, and then the TGF beta can go off and do its stuff. And we know that from a separate paper, children with defects in TGF-beta get very early onset IBD. And now we've seen that children with ITGAV, integrin variant defects, either complete loss of function or more or less loss of function, also get very early onset IBD. So it is a totally consistent story and underscores the importance of this pathway in at least the developmental integrity and immune regulation of the bowel.
It's too late to do anything in these children, I suppose, for the central nervous system defects they've come to attention that the brain is formed. What can you do? But the colitis is an ongoing problem. The immunodeficiency is an ongoing problem. How far away are, and it's an ongoing problem linked to not enough TGF-beta knocking about. How far are we from using enterically coated TGF-beta to treat colitis?
I think that people would have concerns about giving TGF-beta in a that form on the basis that it is such a almost ubiquitous molecule that seems to do a bit of everything and a bit of everything badly. So, but too much of it is very much associated with fibrosis, and I'm interested from a liver scarring perspective, but it is, as we've seen here and elsewhere, it is absolutely needed for normal development, and therefore loss of it gives you immune dysfunction. It's been implicated in basically every single cancer, whether that's directly from the malignant cells themselves or whether that's part of the stroma. And this is probably why, even though it comes up as such a mechanistically important target in loads of different disorders, why there isn't a clear TGF-beta targeted therapy so far, which probably means that you just need to keep on digging down and digging down. Now, the reason that it's particularly interesting that they found an integrin here to be involved is that there are, albeit in a different context, there are different anti-integrin immunoglobulins, or sorry, antibodies, which are now in routine use for treatment of IBD. So whether it would then need to be a stimulating antibody, or the other thing is, as you've discussed, SMAD3, one of my favorite SMADs, is downregulated activity here, whether that's could be targeted through a small molecule activator. There, it gives a whole range of other targeting options.
Is there a place for actually measuring TGF-beta or TGF-beta activity in mucosal biopsy samples?
I suppose you could. Now in the era of single-cell omics, I suppose I would be a little bit skeptical of the meaning of bulk measurement of TGF-beta in a mucosal biopsy, because you could
Right,
have...
I withdraw the suggestion, put it on a slide and do it one cell by one cell, Jake.
Exactly. For example, you could have TGF-beta that's increased because of scar formation or fibrous tissue deposition due to inflammation, but actually you have reduced TGF-beta in other cells that normally provide an immunosuppressive function. So it's tricky.
It's tricky, and so is fitting discussions of cases like this and papers like this into the limited time we have available. And I think we have run out of time. Jake, thank you for shepherding us through what is certainly a complex business to understand. And if you've managed to listen this far, remember, SMAD3 is, of course, just a nickname for S. Mothers Against Decapentaplegic Homolog 3. Jake, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for taking the time to, thank you for going through these articles with us.
Thanks very much.